So, I'm a little under the weather, so any incoherence or boring statements are to be blamed on my. It's easier that way. It's not my fault. Curious, how many people came tonight, particularly for the topic that was described? A few people. Okay, I'll try and talk about it. I don't normally give talks that way because I like to just kind of feel the field and see what is resonant. But maybe that's what's alive right now. So didn't like the topic the title, because I think it's called it Sila. Was it the Sila of Thought? Is that right? Then. How thoughts can cause harm. And so Sila means ethics, kind of the ethical relationship to something. Where that topic came to mind was a friend of mine had gone to Burma to be with at different retreat centers, but she was with Sayadaw Upandita, and they were playing a number of his, actually it was after he had passed away, so they were playing some of his recordings, and apparently this topic, Sila of Thought, was played over a number of days. And I heard this phrase, oh, the Sila of Thought, and I was intrigued by it, and I sort of was thinking about it, and I mentioned it during a talk, and a whole bunch of people afterwards said, oh, I'd love to hear those talks. And so I tried to find them, and I couldn't. I'd have to go to Burma, I think, and be with Sayadaw Upandita. And anyways, I was told that these series of talks are very boring. So don't worry about the actual content. But what I liked about it was Sila, right, as a foundation for our practice. We all know about it, right? It tends to be about our actions and speech. So the main precepts that we take of not killing, not stealing, not using our sexual energy in a harmful way, being mindful of our speech, impact of our speech, and then not using drugs and intoxicants that prevent our clarity of mind from seeing things the way they are. So all of those are behavioral things, speech and actions, things that we can actually do some restraint around. But thought isn't often, it's not really in the category of Sila. And it's interesting to think why it isn't, and why is action and speech things that we try to be careful around, or why it's even given guidance. You know, don't do certain things. I've often thought about in retreat environments particularly, but even now, you know, just sitting here, this is a retreat environment in a way, being quiet or not speaking out loud and not doing things that are causing harm. That alone has such transformative powers, right? Just by not agitating the mind. So after an hour of sitting, we might have had a lot of agitating thoughts and emotions, but there's not that much regret. Right? We're not regretting that time that's spent. And so far in my practice, I've never regretted a moment that I was mindful or a moment that I spent in retreat environment or during the years I was a monk. It's like no moment of that did I regret, because there was nothing remorseful about it. It was all kind of onward leading, cultivating. But thoughts, right, thoughts are subtle. They're habits of mind. They spring forward, and we can see that we don't really get to choose what thoughts we have. Does that seem to be true to you? Anyone able to have exactly the thoughts they want to have? So it's a little bit less now, but I have a particular facility for shame. You're probably thinking I was going to say for concentration, something amazing. But I have an easy time to feel shame because I've practiced it a lot, right? It's like, as the Buddha said, that which you frequently think upon becomes the inclination of the mind. So we practice, we're always practicing something, right? Practicing being distracted, practicing thinking about ourselves, practicing comparing or judging, or any moment that we're being aware, we're practicing mindfulness. That's why it doesn't matter what it is we're aware of. Doesn't matter. Unpleasant state of mind, wholesome state of mind, the breath, subtle thoughts, doesn't matter, right? We're growing. We're growing in our practice, growing in awareness. So around shame, because I've experienced it now so frequently, now that I've given myself wonderful opportunities to experience shame, because I put myself in front of groups where normally I would have avoided at all costs. It's like, oh, there's a group, run away, go in the opposite direction. Right, because that was my fear. And so then I started to discover other habit patterns that I wouldn't have explored, which is the after effects of being exposed and vulnerable. Oh, that comes with tenderness, comes with, you know, I want to be liked by everyone. I remember when I was something like 12 or 13, during a presidential election, and my parents explaining that the country usually divides in two, you know, roughly, it's just wherever the politics are, it just divides in two. And I remember telling them, I was like, oh, I couldn't be president because I need everyone to like me. So I couldn't have just half the country like me. Right? So we all want this. We all want to be liked. So one of the things that I was discovering around shame, right, is it seemed to be preceded with these thoughts. And there are shameful thoughts, you know, thoughts around not being good enough, not doing things well enough, should be better, should have been better. And I had a whole process of getting to know this realm of activity for me, this emotional territory of shame and thought. And what happened was, as I would emerge out of a talk, which normally would, it's like a tidal wave of shame would hit, I began to actually see some of the thoughts that would arise, that would precede the thought. I'd actually be able to hear them. And that was new. That was new territory. I didn't realize I was thinking something. But the beginning process of that was I would actually hear these thoughts telling me things about myself, and it would basically be saying, come, believe me, you are worthless, you're no good, you're awful, you're a fake, whatever the story was. And instantaneously I would say, yeah, you're right. Right, I'll believe you. And I could even see the thought coming from far away, going, come this way, come suffer, come. And I'd hear it calling. And amazingly, I would say, sure, let's go do this together. And then I would go down the hole of suffering for a while. In our, you know, in our daily life, things are moving so fast, right? We're having so many thoughts all day long. So many moods getting triggered by it. And it's very difficult to see that that activity is happening. We think we're just experiencing the world. We're experiencing ourselves accurately. And one of the phrases in the Dharma says, there is this tangle. You know, and who is going to untangle this tangle? How do we untangle this tangle of our mind and heart, our experience? So as we pay attention to what's happening, it really is undeniable, the things that are pointed to. Right? Simple things like there is suffering, there is changing states of mind, the body is not in our control. Thoughts, right, habits of mind, they happen, and they happen very quickly, and they're very seductive. So it's astounding to me that even though I could be aware that something would be calling me towards it, that would be a hurtful thing to believe, it was the most familiar thing that my mind knew, and so I would believe it. And not so long ago, at one point, it was amazing to see it. The thought was there, a shameful thought. And there was enough awareness, enough wisdom to really see it and say, oh, you're a thought. You're just a thought. If I believe you, it'll cause the emotion, right, that follows. And my sense of identity will get formed around it. Who I am gets triggered by that. So to me, that's a little bit looking into the sila of thought, the ethics of thought. What is a thought being motivated by? Is it being motivated by kindness? Is it being motivated by right views? Right, right views being anything that is the Dhamma. So this is, for example, this is an emotion, or this is just a thought. This is just pain. This is unpleasant. This is aversion, reactivity. Right? This is how we begin to disidentify with what's happening. Where to go from here? Let me see if there's any questions currently, and if there's nothing springing to mind, I'll see what else comes. Yeah.
I was thinking that sila often has to do with refraining from something.
Mm-hmm.
So I was thinking, was there a refraining action in what you're describing? But it doesn't seem like there's a refraining. It's more
right, yeah. So the question is, sila often feels as if there's refraining from, and the question being, was I actually refraining? And it didn't sound like so much of refraining from that activity. I'd say this is part, there's a subtle balance in our practice, I feel, that is both a meeting what's here, right? We want to learn about the nature of what's unwholesome, and we want to learn about the nature of what's wholesome. We want to understand why is acting out of delusion, out of clinging and attachment, why is that unwholesome? Why does that create suffering? And we can try and do our spiritual path perfectly, try and behave really well, we know all the right things to do, we know all the right things to say, but the way wisdom gets developed, truly developed, is when we've seen something, right? We really see it, we're open to it. So there is a balance inside that is, there is the not feeding something that's based in an unwholesome state of mind. So for example, suppose we are feeling agitation towards something or towards someone. Feeding that would be to continue to tell the story about that person, let's say. So that would be feeding it. We could say it's an act of restraint, But it's not so much a strain as much as really choosing to observe, oh, this is aversion, and here's the story. So we're feeling the aversion, knowing that that's what's present, that's true, it's what's arising. And really over time, the true restraint, the restraint that is a refuge, that's very reliable, is the wisdom that knows, oh, this is not helpful. So when I have seen shame, for example, again and again, I know that thought that will lead to shame. I've seen it. I understand its trigger. I know that it makes me kind of form around that identity, that it makes me want to hide and escape. But as I've seen it now, I begin to realize, oh, shame has its own territory, has its own landscape. It's something I can be aware of. I can actually move towards it with interest. Oh, what is this? How does it feel? How does it make the mind feel, the heart feel? So as much as I'm not stopping that process, I'm not actually allowing my mind to just buy into the story, right? And this is where when we actually really see what's motivating a particular thought story about ourselves, for example, a lot of depression is, for it to continue, the fuel of that requires negative thinking. I have to be thinking negatively about myself or about my circumstances. And if we look at it carefully, what is unwholesome in that, right, is a lot of wrong views. So anytime the mind is saying, this shouldn't be happening, it's a wrong view. It shouldn't be. Right? Or I should be something. Right? With right views, we begin to really open to something as it is. Oh, this is unpleasant. This sensation, this emotion, this experience. And less we actually are following the concepts of our thoughts, the stories, the movie, right? We're creating a movie and we look at it and we go, oh yes. And that becomes more real to us than the simplicity of our breath, than the fact that we're seeing right now, that we're hearing, or how we're feeling. So this is what the Buddha was pointing to, right? Right at the heart of our practice is this wakefulness. We're awake to what's happening, right? And that's where a natural restraint starts to arise, and it's because I haven't heard those particular talks. My kind of assumption is around the sila of thought is once one knows what's motivating a thought and one has seen it enough times, the discernment is if it's based in wholesomeness, in wisdom, in right view, that'll grow. That kind of thinking grows. Thoughts of right view, right? Reminding ourselves this is simply happening. This is a cause and effect process. It's not wrong to be having this experience. So those thoughts can get increased, thoughts of compassion, kindness, loving kindness. And then anything that leads towards suffering, we naturally let it go. But that's really a process of wisdom. And wisdom over time will see why something burns. Oh, this is suffering. Almost effortless at that point, not even needing to stop something. The habit might still be there of having a thought, but it's just less powerful. You just see it as a thought comes into the mind, goes. Yeah, right. Yes?
I'm curious if you can talk about the role of cultivation of certain positive things. So, practice like the Bhagavad Gita or kindness, in sort of how to use that in this context of ethical thought or changing habits of mind that is in relation to also the observing of and the seeing into with insight, maybe the negative habits of mind, sort of how those can be utilized.
Yeah, so the question, or yeah, question being around just the use of using positive thinking, positive thoughts around being a counter, right, to negative habits of mind. Yeah, in the Dharma, there's so many skillful means that are offered, and the Buddha did offer kind of replacing one thought for another, a wholesome thought. So oftentimes, a lot of particularly negative thoughts about oneself, when we begin to substitute those with thoughts of compassion, thoughts of kindness, that can be a benefit to the mind. In my own practice, and the way I really learned with Sayadaw Tejaniya, he encouraged me a lot to be aware of what my motivation was in the substitution. Because he wanted me to catch, was I just feeling aversive to what was there, and then in a way trying to feel better by bringing in something that was wholesome? And if possible, to really open to the aversion towards a state of mind or to what the thought is making us feel, if we can do that. And there's plenty of times where what we really need is learning how to be balanced right now. What is it that enables me to be with this experience? So oftentimes that means for different circumstances, let me remind myself to be kind. Oh, it's okay. It's okay to feel this way right now. I'm worthy of being here. I'm allowed to take up space, right? I'm a human being. I'm justified to have this experience right now. So very compassionate thoughts can help to counter, negative thinking. The caution I would have just around that, and it's not so much a caution, it's just to be aware of the possibility that sometimes we miss the opportunity to learn how to shift our attitude towards what is already here without replacing it with a more pleasant experience. You know, metta, if it's not being done just as a practice, but I'm trying to make myself feel better, can almost be like, I don't like to feel the unpleasantness of experience. We don't ever get to really learn about what it means to feel aversion in our mind. And to really recognize what it feels like to feel aversive, or to feel clinging and grasping, these basic energies that's so fundamental to what the Buddha was pointing to as being really the cause of why we're suffering, these reactive states of mind. Loving kindness and these other practices can actually help put the mind in a state of mind that allows us again to be balanced and to open to what's here. So if that's the case, then, you know, we just want to explore, see what is it that enables me to gain a sense of balance, a sense of ease, that then I can open to what's here. Right, what's here. And I've heard oftentimes some people will say, because they had gotten almost like it was an escape route to kind of go to metta anytime the mind was getting aversive, there was a habit of aversion to unpleasant states. So rather than just kind of unconsciously feeding that by skipping into metta, sometimes it can be helpful to really explore the territory of what does it feel like right now to feel agitated. So you're changing your attitude towards it of being interested in an aversive state, let's say. Rather than just, you know, I can easily bring in metta and then I'm just kind of pleasantly covering over what is already there, which is a habit of mind worth getting to know and not feeling bad about having that state. So that's the power, you know, of right view, which is it just reminds us what is here because it's conditioned. Not wrong. It may be unskillful, but it's not wrong. Right? It's anything, any habit, not wrong, just conditioned. The whole range, right? But unaware, they cause suffering. Right? Habits of mind cause a lot of suffering. But even then, we really start to see them as habits of mind. And that's really, really a deep source of compassion and forgiveness comes from for other people also, is we really recognize that when there's delusion in someone else's mind, fear and anxiety, they're overwhelmed, whatever it is, they're going to act those things out. And we see then the lawfulness of conditioning, and not so much from getting caught into the blaming state of mind. Yeah.
It was really interesting when you said covering it over. It made me think of something that I went through when I was younger. I used to do a lot of public speaking that was really difficult for me. And every time I did it, I would break out this rash across my neck and chest. And so what I learned to do was to always speak with a scarf around my neck to cover that over. But still get up and do the talk.
Good for you, yeah.
And so it was a help to cover it over. It allowed me to then get up with less shame. But then still experience the anxiety was still there. So I was still in that anxiety and doing the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it just reminded me of that when you said covering it over.
Yeah.
And now I don't have to.
Yeah, could everyone hear that? Just getting red and a rash around the neck and using a scarf to cover it over. My redness still happens a bit, but bright red cheeks. So it was like an advertisement to everyone. Like my state of mind was made visible to everyone. And it was unmistakable. It wasn't like heightened self-consciousness. It was, here it is. And it's hard, it's like, being human, there's just so many ways to suffer. And we're very creative around how to do it. It's like we ought to feel kind of content about how creative we are in all the ways we figure out to suffer in one day. It's amazing. But the roots of them are relatively, it's like repetitive. There's the identification to what arises. So when I'm very identified here with my body, very identified with my emotions, there's no space. So then if there's no space, I have to escape. I cannot experience what's unpleasant, right? But when we're mindful, aware, things are being known, then I can start to feel the unpleasantness of feeling emotion like shame and then being seen by other people or, feeling the racing heart. That was, some early steps for me, just the heart racing. But increasingly with awareness, we actually start to be able to be open to these edges, whatever it is. I'm not afraid to be with an edge. Different emotions. So this is where the invitation to be honest, to be exposed, to be real in our practice. I remember someone was asking Ajahn Chah once, he was like, so many monks seem to, monks and nuns practice as long as you, but you seem to have gone so far in the practice. What was it about your practice that did that? He said, I took risks. And when I think, for me, what does it mean to take a risk? It's like it's to be real, to be with what's here, not to pretend otherwise, right? To be here, honest. It's like this, right? Well, however it is. And if we're not, and this is where I was sort of saying about the covering over at times, we're kind of covering things over, trying to get to the more pleasant. Oftentimes we miss something that could potentially be liberating. We underestimate our capacity to be with something that's difficult. Now, how do we do a hard conversation mindfully? We should try. be really aware, moving into a hard conversation, knowing how you're feeling, remembering that you're seeing, that you're hearing, and still move into that territory. It's an edge. You know, yes, it's hard. So we'd rather just go into it kind of unaware in a way and just kind of get our point of view across and, right, just in a really agitated state. But actually, how do I begin to bring mindfulness into territories that are unfamiliar, uncomfortable? This is how we expand, you know, we kind of grow, keep growing. Listening, it's like mindfulness in a way is listening, deep listening to things that we sort of are always there, pulling the strings of our personality, our habits. How do we begin to include that? It's like allowing the awareness to grow, include more, listening to ourselves, just listening. Right? So it doesn't, then it's like, if that's the process, we're just listening, I find everything is invited. I don't need to be different than I currently am, because this is what's here, and this is what I can be aware of. So this is actually what's going to support my awareness, my wisdom. And we think what's going to help support my awareness and wisdom is actually getting peaceful, getting a good experience. But what's here is what's possible to be aware of. So we get better and better at that, better and better. Did you want to, yeah?
Yeah, I want to take that risk right now.
Great.
Because I was a member of the Sangha for a long time, and I lived somewhere else now. And I have, in all the years I've ever came here, I have never spoken out in this group ever.
Mm-hmm.
Terrified, heart pounding, back spasms,
yes. Yes.
All of that. And I have learned how to access my voice.
Yeah.
And that is by going deep inside and connecting, first of all, just being, pausing, relaxing, being with everything that's happening inside of me.
Beautiful.
And then just accessing the truth.
Yeah.
And speaking that truth.
Yeah.
And that has made me liberated.
Yeah.
And I work on that all the time now, and I always take risks. I push myself through that.
Mm.
Well, not push. I just.
Yeah, you stepped into it.
And my people around me who know me give me a little nudge. You can do this. And I go, okay, I will take that risk again.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Thank you. So in all the years of coming here, she was just sharing that she's never spoken up before, just the amount of, even small groups, me too, small groups. As soon as it's over 3 people, it's like, that's a group, right?
Two
is a group, yeah, that's right, 2 people. And anytime it's like formal, it's like, now you have to present yourself. It's like, which is just concepts in the mind, right? It's powerful. And if those concepts have been conditioned to be associated around fear and anxiety, that's what gets triggered really strong. So I was noticing, like, for myself, to be aware that I'm going to, you know, I was with Sumedho once asking him, he's coming, I see, you know. I was asking him, we were in a car on the way to the airport, and he was going to go teach somewhere. I was like, so how do you, this is a bunch of years ago now, but how do you not be afraid of public speaking? He said, oh, it's very easy for me to be afraid of public speaking. All I need to do is think about it. I was like, wow, even you, because like his, you know, it's, oh, this is Ajahn Sumedho, and it's like, you know, deep, resonant voice. But he also suffered from, and he talks about it sometimes in his talks, a lot of fear. Go ahead, yes.
I met a couple of your students at an Insight Dialogue retreat this last week, and they talked about so I thought, oh, I'll Google you and find out, and I wanted to see you actually speak in like a video, but I couldn't find it. But I saw it in Seattle Insight, and I happened to be here today. And then I realized, it's today, and you are here, so I'm coming.
Yeah, I'm coming too. Here we are. Yeah. I think that's one of the things we really do discover in in our mindfulness practice, and even in little ways in the beginning. I remember sitting down for the first time, and like every 2 minutes I had to move. Every 2 minutes I had to look at these people. I was like, how are they sitting there? How do they do that? Right? So then with awareness, we start to recognize, oh, you can begin to feel an experience that's unpleasant. You can feel it. You can be aware of it. But before that, we're completely identified. There's no clarity, no wisdom around it. And that's, you know, we could say that's basic cause of suffering is the identification with experience. We cling and attach to body and mind. And the more we're clinging to an experience, which is just a natural unfolding of processes, but the more clinging there is, when it's unpleasant, we don't want to get rid of it, right? We want to push it away. And when it's pleasant, we want to hold on to it. We need it. I need this to feel better. I need this. I need this. This is the addictive tendencies. Both of them. Both just, and this is, you know, we say habits of mind. These habits are obsessive, right? But the habits of mind that come with wholesome tendencies, open, they give space, can choose, can respond, be open, learn, watch, be interested, right? So then we can go towards things that are a bit more challenging. Yeah, and I find it's like, it's a radical thing to be in, you know, Insight Dialogue does this, but to be kind of in relationship, but to be trusting being mindful. Because normally what we trust is my personality, right? I'm gonna try and be me in relation to you, and being me means I've got to get your approval, I've got to make you laugh, I've got to, right? Whatever it is, and I get very stuck, my space gets very narrow. But as we kind of open to experiences, it's a very different experience. I can watch, can be aware of, I can receive what, you know, where you are, not afraid to feel doubt and uncertainty. I mean, I'm still going to act out a lot of stuff, but now it becomes something that we can, you know, I'm learning from, we learn. Yeah. Great, good to see you. Yeah. Feel free to bring any question to mind. Open territory. It doesn't have to be around the topic. Anything at all. Yeah, reflections, comments, yeah.
So in discussing this topic with a Zen teacher, the phrase that she engages is to guard the mind.
Guard in the mind, yeah. Oh, guarding or gardening? Guarding the mind, guarding, yeah. Yeah.
So to guard the mind, observing. And so for the men in the circle, there was a sense of sort of austerity and rigor and sort of the more masculine archetype of guard. And for the women, there was more of a shepherding, nurturing, like,
yeah, did anyone not hear that? Did not hear? So there was, I think with a Zen teacher, there was a phrase of guarding the mind in relation to sort of these topics of how to look after the mind. And then just noticing these kind of basic differences that tend to be aligned more masculine and feminine, that for masculine energy, the men were reporting guarding being one of kind of austere holding at bay, and for the more feminine type of energy was really shepherding.
But it was just that different people's, you know, that for some people
when she invoked this phrase,
to guard.
They were like, oh, that sounds awful. That sounds like militaristic and, you know, sort of forcing out of the barricade the unwanted thoughts, as you were describing before. Whereas for others, it was like, oh, no, it's not about pushing away. It's about kind of protecting, nurturing, attending. Is this skillful? Is this not skillful?
Yeah, that's great. Good. I mean, that's in a way, it's the conditioning nature of language. We hear something, and depending on our own conditioning, we think oftentimes it's me interpreting. It's not. It's just the mind interpreting how we hear something. You know, we say the word to. I remember there was a retreat, sort of watch to be aware of your emotion. So for someone, it was like that meant that they were really watching like this. And until the word feel was invoked, there was sort of intimacy they weren't invited into being intimate with what was there, because watching had this pulling back. So it's just interesting to explore for ourselves, how am I using my mind? You know, am I watching in a way that's kind of distant? You know, so it's really far back and just, you know, and maybe that has a bit of like holding away. Or am I also then watching in a way that just keeps me entangled as well? So there's, maybe that's too entangled. But then how do I know something very intimately as it is? Right? So that we're really there knowing something and we're not meeting it either with entanglement, clinging, or with pushing it away. There's just this immediacy of knowing. Yes.
Toward the end of the meditation period, you said something about like meditation shouldn't be tiring.
Right. Yeah. Yes. That the more you try, you said sometimes?
Particularly yeah. When I'm tired.
Oh, when you're tired, yeah. Yeah. Very easy for that to happen, you know. Everyone in the world, we're exhausted. I think just universally, there's a level of exhaustion that people experience because habits of mind tend to be based in the reactive patterns, right? We identify in small ways reacting against or towards all the time. That's tiring. And we can feel it, you know, if you get to go on retreats. If you've ever been on a retreat, it's, you know, there's a sense of rest and ease almost that one never gets to experience. Even trying to go on a vacation, there's still an ongoing doing. So what I was trying to point to in the practice is really to check how am I practicing right now? How much energy am I putting in? Is the energy that I'm putting in based in wanting something to be different? Is it based in some struggle, some agitation? Because most of the energy that we put in tends to be wrong energy. Wrong meaning it's out of some kind of agenda, right? And this is, you know, from my own teacher's encouragement around to really explore what does it mean to have wise effort in practice. And we think wise effort kind of, you know, looks like this, you know, it's like, you know, it's like, because it's like, well, he's not sitting this time. But, you know, oftentimes, the Buddha will be sitting and looking perfect. So then we try and do that. And we get these messages of what it means to meditate. What does it really mean to meditate? What does it mean to you to meditate? Does it mean your eyes are closed? Does it mean sitting still? Does it mean getting what you want? Right? probably does mean a bunch of those things, right? So if I say, okay, let's start practicing right now. Okay, let's practice together for 20 seconds. So we would all move, right? We'd all go, okay, let's kind of take our seat. And like, okay, here we go. Okay, now start. Okay. And then we start, right? It's like, okay, go. And then I ring the bell. Stop. Stop meditating. Oh, okay. Oh, that's so peaceful to stop meditating. Right? So what does it mean it's peaceful? It means we stop trying to do something, trying to get something. But I would say ring the bell at the beginning and have that be the sound of stop meditating. Okay, so at the beginning of a sitting, stop. Okay, now just don't do anything. Can you hear the sound of the bell? Not hard. Do you know, generally, are you feeling, how are you feeling? Just generally. Not hard. Useful. What's hard is to really give ourselves permission to do that. Really hard. That's why nibbana, right, peace, cooling out, the extinguishment of these energies that really are neurotic. We're all neurotic. I used to think like becoming enlightened was like superhero. Like you, if you become an arahant, an enlightened being, it like you're going to get a cape, you know, in the mail or something. You'll be part of a superhero gang. You know, so we think of it being extraordinary, but actually it's not so neurotic. You know, we're not being fueled by trying, by striving, by getting rid of. There's a more relaxed, settled way of being with experience. So we get, you know, sitting is important because it's a safe place, hopefully. Not overwhelmed. We're not needing to do a lot, so we get to just train ourselves. Okay, we can close the eyes. Fine. And get good at being there. But if we narrow our understanding of practice down to eyes being closed, right, and sitting still, then we don't appreciate the ability to be aware when we're angry. It's not hard to know anger. It's an obvious emotion. It should be very easy, right? So you should appreciate, oh good, I'm angry. It's so easy to be mindful right now because I know I am bloody angry. Right? But no one, we don't do that. We say is, you know, we have a kind of a judgmental view around it. So right view reminds us how to meet experience as it is. Oh, anger, doubt, shame, frustration, boredom, heat, sweating. I'm sweating. Yeah. A little bit. Blame the light. Right, so it becomes really easeful, this sort of natural continuity of awareness. And you know, with Utejaniya, he loves to teach sanghas that are practicing in daily life because it's what he excels at, and really transmitted that to me, to not take our experience as being the basis for whether or not we're meditating. We don't need to be getting a good experience. Wherever we are, any state, any moment, just enough. If you know how you're feeling, enough. If you remember that you're seeing, that's enough. Remember that you're hearing, that's enough. Right? If we practice that again and again, the continuity of awareness grows. And then it's almost, it just starts to follow us. It's wherever we go. And then we learn about ourselves, we learn about our habits, learn about what's skillful, what's unskillful. So being tired in the sitting, some of the tired is because we actually begin to recognize how tired we actually are. But if we're getting tired from practice, check to see what it is that you're trying to do. Right, and that's something to be aware of. So if there's a sense of struggle, begin to recognize that. And oftentimes we miss it because we're leaning outward, leaning towards the object. We need to know the quality of our mind that's meditating. And so that's when I say, like, check the mind, how are you practicing? How much energy are you putting in? What's your relationship to the experience? How am I relating to this moment? Is there a sense of receptive, open, allowing? Or is there some struggle with what's there? And if there's struggle and tension, we just start to feel it. That's fine. Whatever's here, right? Whatever's here. We're using it to grow awareness and wisdom. Whatever's here. Great. Yeah, yeah.
One of the things that I've been trying to work on is right speech. And I so automatically do not write speech. It's very humbling. And also, kind of in line with what you were just saying, I think a lot about
mm-hmm.
And it feels good to have that concept. And then again, you know, it's like, where was I for the last 5 minutes? You know, I was being very efficient, you know, doing things very well, and completely gone. It's kind of amazing.
Yes, it's good to see it as amazing. It's amazing. So just the comment of how easy it is to go into autopilot. It's amazing. It's amazing. It's like I wake up, you know, you can wake up. Today I will be mindful. You get out of bed and you're not mindful. It's like, okay, that didn't take long. You know? So that we can see, it's like, oh, right. So our practice is to understand even this, even developing awareness, that's not something we can control, but we can condition. Can condition in the sense of supporting ourselves to be aware, to be mindful. And, you know, it's so easy because our habits of self-judgment and inner critic and all this, easy to turn our practice back in on ourselves as I should be doing it better. I should have been more, you know, I should have been more kind in my speech, more wise in my speech, right? Now, the reason why we weren't kind in our speech when we, whatever it is that we said, was because those conditions were there, right? We didn't have enough momentum of awareness and wisdom, and so, boom, right? So that was said. So if we keep turning our view towards right view and reminding ourselves, we don't need to judge ourselves. You don't need to judge. Judgment happens, okay, so then we don't need to judge the judgment. But each time we bring in right view, there's a sense of, oh, right, these are habits of mind. They're very deeply conditioned. And my job is to be interested in them and to grow awareness, to grow right view. And increasingly then, whatever is happening in our life, it's like we're giving ourselves permission to be there for it and to learn from it. When we're present, we can know something. When we're just caught and identified on autopilot, yeah, okay, that's what goes on. When we wake up again, great, we can feel that. Sometimes we can feel the residue of that, and that helps to bring insight. Oh, that's not how I want to live. That has residue, right? Or feel the impact of having said something unskillful. Ah, right. Lot of change. If we learn how to speak mindfully, so the awareness is there as we speak, a lot of change. A lot of change. When I first began exploring, speaking, hearing the sound of my voice, that was a big change for me. I had never heard the sound of my voice as I spoke, mindfully. I heard it, but I wasn't aware in the moment of my voice as I was speaking. So that became an extra anchor in my practice, oh, so now when I speak, I always hear the sound of my voice. So it's like an extra support to be mindful. So if we keep growing things that are supportive in our practice, it becomes easier to be mindful. You hear yourself. You know, that's like, well, I don't, you know, and it's like speaking mindfully. At first, like when I started really listening to my voice, this sounds weird. Like my voice sounds weird. And then me speaking mindfully sounds even weirder. Right, and no one's gonna want to be my friend if I speak like this all the time. But anyway, so then we learn how to actually, in a natural way, be mindful. And then, you know, but in the beginning, yeah, maybe it's a little different. But that's part of the courage is how do I do this life skillfully? And I've yet to see life really be lived truly skillfully, unaware, just reactive. In a reactive, ongoing state. It's just not possible. Because habits of mind are powerful, and they tend to be conditioned by greed, fear, confusion, all of these things, you know, needing. But with awareness, we then begin to really be able to nurture what's skillful, and the wisdom lets go, right, of what's not skillful. Yes? Yeah, so just, you know, the question of whether or not the actual thought, can it cause harm? I don't know. I mean, you know, I would normally, in a Western modality, we would say no. But, you know, the boundary of consciousness, where is the boundary of consciousness? There's no boundary to awareness. It sort of just knows the impingement of sense contact. And I think sometimes the boundaries of things start to feel looser. And so this inner penetrative space, I think sometimes you can walk into a room and feel kind of, who knows, is it visual or is it felt? Is there something? I was teaching the long retreat, the 6-week retreat, 3-month retreat at IMS this last year. And the election happened during the retreat. So there's a general, a lot of reactions, you know. Not all one side or the other, but there was a general reaction. And for those that didn't look at, we put the note on the board for people that wanted to look, and they had asked for this. So if you want to look, you can lift the flap up and then put it back down. So even for those that didn't want to look, they knew, right? Unless there is, you know, a handful of people who are very secluded, keeping really to themselves, you know, for them it wasn't known. But so it's hard to say. But I oftentimes feel like I can. It may be visual cues, but it feels if you can tell someone's state of mind. You don't need to hear them say something angry back. You can kind of sometimes feel it. But I've also been amazed at how many stories the mind makes up, assumptions. Right? And I was just sharing recently, at a retreat recently, at the very end, so one person did a gesture and they looked up like this as I was sharing something. It was just at the closing. And so my interpretation was, oh, I said something really kind of off-putting, and they're rolling their eyes, right? Like, oh God, like this, you know. And then another person made the exact same gesture. And I had no reaction at all. And I was being mindful, so I felt the impact. And I had this insight, I was like, oh my God, it's so clear. How much the mind just assumes it knows things, and then how much meaning gets created, and then we buy into it. We totally buy into what the mind is fabricating all the time, accurately or inaccurately. We buy into it. Right? We don't even know that the mind is making, right? So this is part of perception. We are perceiving the reality of the world around us. The world isn't just there. It needs to be recreated, right, in our mind. So you don't see that. You don't see perception happening. And then afterwards, I actually had a chance to talk to one of the people, and the one who I thought rolled their eyes was saying how much they appreciated every word that I said, you know. I was like, oh my God, that's amazing. That's amazing. I was sure, as I have described the moment, they're like, oh no, you said something. I was just, you know, looking up, taking it in. I had no idea. So who knows? But it is good to see that the mind interprets, makes assumptions, has views. Sometimes they're right, sometimes they're not. But if we see that the mind is doing that, and then we see our certainty around it, that's insight. That's understanding. Again, Ajahn Chah, he had this refrain he would oftentimes say, not sure. Not sure. Just as in a general way with experience, not sure. It's sort of like the understanding of conditionality of life. Things just unfolding, moment by moment. We don't know. You know, so when I say I'll see you later now, in my mind actually, I use it as a phrase, but in my mind I hear it, not sure, don't know.
But, I appreciate you saying that.
Great. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And it's never going to be the person up here, their insight, that is going to liberate our mind. We need to have our own interest in the Dharma. It has to come from within. You know, that's one of the things I really appreciated studying with Utejaniya, is just he didn't talk so much about the insights that I will have. He just taught me how to practice and be interested. Be interested in your own life. Be interested. Just keep watching. Keep watching. Right? So if we do that, yeah, you're going to learn a lot. But if we read all the things about, you know, anicca, dukkha, anatta, things are not self, we hear it, it's like, then we overlay our own views and opinions about the world or what we hear about spiritual truths, and we kind of get confused. What am I actually experiencing? I don't even know anymore. So how do I learn? What am I actually experiencing? Whatever it is, it can be the simplest emotion, but when you know it directly, right, there's a freedom in that. I know directly what I'm experiencing. Oh, that's the confidence, that's faith in the Dharma. Yeah. Did you want to? And we should. We'll probably finish with this. Yeah.
Sometimes I have noticed when I'm speaking or talking to people, and if I'm mindful, I can hear myself.
Right.
But most of the time, when I'm hearing, I don't like what I'm hearing. So then I wonder. Naturally, nobody else likes what I'm hearing. Whatever I said.
Yeah. 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 I mean, I would say, just to say, most of what we say, we don't need to say. Honestly, we don't need to say it. So just take the pressure off yourself. You don't have to say, you know. And that's part of being mindful also, is we watch our own aversion to ourself. That's important to see that, how we easily judge ourselves. So easy. So easy. This is important, really important. So if you get that chance while you're speaking and you know, try being mindful and you see the aversion arise towards yourself, that's already there, right? It's already there. That seed in the mind, it's acting out in other ways, or it's a seed waiting to come. This is where we want to see, right? It's the seeing. The seeing it again and again. Slowly it loses its power. Loses its power, right? So then, like, recovering phobic people around public speaking, it's like, yeah, we're getting somewhere, right? Yeah, we can. It's like, okay, I can be with the edge of anxiety and exposure and vulnerability and feel that and feel the trembling. I don't have to get it perfect. And that's powerful. Just simple. Very simple. I did say last question, so last question. I'll repeat last question because we're still 2 minutes.
It kind of goes along with what you're saying.
Great, okay.
You mentioned earlier that we want to hold on to these good feelings when we feel them. Lately, I've noticed that it's like my body and my mind want to hold on to worry in particular.
Yes.
And you don't want to let go.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. If you stop worrying, you think something even worse might happen?
Yeah.
Let me think, have I done that? tell me a little bit more, without getting into details, can you tell me a little bit more about what's happening? So you feel as if you were to stop worrying, so you're holding on to the worry.
I'm holding on to the worry.
Yeah.
Fear.
Yeah.
Like, and I can't, and you know, people around me are like, what are you worrying for? It's not going to change the outcome.
Right. Right.
But I don't know how to get out of it.
Yeah, yeah.
My body won't let go of it.
Yeah, yeah. There's a phrase that I think Carol Wilson, if you know her, she's a Dharma teacher. She's someone I teach with a lot. And I think it's her phrase. She says something like, aversion, pushing away, will marry us to the thing just as much as holding on or wanting. So we're bound to experiences that we feel aversion towards, and anxiety and worry is underlying it, right? That's the root of that, has aversion in it. So when we feel aversive towards something, worrying about it, we're really bound to it. The mind gets obsessed around it. On that level, on another level, there's also what is hard about change is that we're being asked to let go of what's familiar, right? I would love to have let go of fears of public speaking. I loved it. I would have, it's like, you know, getting red. I remember it's like asking my mom, it's like, I'm getting so red in class, fifth grade, everyone can see it, will it ever go away? Wanting it to go away, you know? No idea what point I was going to make. What was that? Yeah, being tied to it. And we get clung and identified. Yeah, so, yeah, I would like to, you know, we want to be able to get rid of things that aren't serving us. So fear and anxiety, worry. But it's so familiar. It's almost like, I don't know how to not do this. I don't know how to not do this, right? So I don't know how not to do this. So then we do it. But then you do it with more awareness, right? Just do it with more awareness, more awareness, more awareness. So in a way, it's like, whatever it is that's happening, can I meet it? Can I meet it? If I tell myself, stop worrying, and this is where a little bit like, I'm a little uncertain about saying things like relax. So it's like, well, if you're relaxed, you can relax. If you're not relaxed, it's like, stop telling me relaxed. I can't relax. I'm tense. So now I want to say, okay, relax, be tense, worry, be sleepy. Like, I just want to give the instructions that people are actually already experiencing. Because then it's like, then it's inviting. Oh, great, I am sleepy. Good, I'm doing the instructions. Okay, be sleepy, you know, be frustrated, be anxious. And then be like, oh, be anxious. Okay, good, I got this one down. So, okay. Just be anxious and be aware, right? Because now you're not meeting it with another level or layer of resistance, of pushing it away. What does it feel like to be anxious? What does it feel like? As you really start to feel it, the wisdom starts to, you know, to grow. And now what's happening is you're growing awareness, that becomes stronger, the anxiety is there. I can be aware and I can feel. I can be aware and I can feel. But we're so used to being stuck in what the mind is worrying about. It's just the stories. So we keep coming back to the emotion. Come to the emotion. There's the anxiety and keep growing the awareness, right? Like that. So we're just getting better and better at being with what's here. Does that sound workable? Don't try and get rid of anxiety. Impossible. Right? But move towards it with interest, with kindness. Oh, anxiety. Not follow the story, because that's like just watching a scary movie. But watch fear. Oh, I can be with that. You know, I hate scary movies. Totally hate it. I don't know why anyone would ever watch a scary movie. But people love it. I don't know, how do you do that? But now I can do it a little bit because I can watch my fear. Right? Watch the fear. And it's just a movie. Watch the fear. Watch the anxiety. Right? Not what the mind is saying. Did you want to say something? I thought you had put your note. Okay. Okay, we've gone over. I hope that's not going to ruin anyone's day. Or night. Let's be mindful for just like 20 seconds, but don't move. Don't get into your meditation posture. Maybe don't even close your eyes. Okay? Just try. And for those of you that haven't explored that, are you aware that you're seeing right now? Yeah. Can you be aware that you're seeing? Yeah, not hard, right? Just takes reminder. Yes, simple being here. Okay. I feel happy to have spent this time with you. That's genuine. So nice to see you.